From T.Lobsang Rampas 11. Book, Feeding the Flame. Introduction. As Dr. Lobsang Rampa lay, desperately ill, in a Canadian hospital, he looked up with pleasure to see his old friend and mentor, the Lama Minya Dondup, standing by his bedside. But it was with some dismay that he listened to the message that the golden figure had brought. Lobsang Rampa's work on this plane was not, as he thought, completed. He had to write another book, his 11th, for there was still more of the mystic truth to be revealed to the world. Here then is that 11th book. Feeding the Flame is mainly concerned with answering some of the many questions which Dr. Rampa's readers have put to him over the years. It covers such subjects as life after death, suicide, meditation and Ouija boards, and includes many invaluable observations on the modern world. Dr. Rampa's many admirers will be delighted that, despite the pain and suffering of his illness, he has been spared to write this fascinating and inspiring book. Yes, also in this book he also gave answers to some of the many letters he received. He daily in average got 60, and tried to answer all of them. What a job only that! Rampa had the ability to follow all incidents by reading, looking in the Akasha, Earth's memory bank, and so retelling the happenings in every detail. Telephone the Astral. From page 24. It is quite possible to make a telephone with which to telephone the astral world. Consider speech now. When we speak, we cause a vibration which imparts its energy to a column of air, which in turn energizes some receiving apparatus, for example, someone's ear, and so they hear the sounds we make. It is interpreted as speech. No one has ever yet succeeded in standing atop a radio mast and shouting to the world, and being heard all over the world. For that the vibrations are transformed into a different form of energy and messages spoken and transformed into this energy can be heard, with suitable apparatus, all over the world. I listen to England, Japan, Australia, Germany - everywhere. I have even heard Little America in the South Antarctic. A device to telephone the astral is something like that. It transforms present-day radio waves into something incomparably higher, just as radio waves in turn are very much higher in frequency than is speech. In days to come, people will be able to telephone those who have newly passed over in much the same way as a person can now telephone a hospital and, if he is lucky and the nurse is feeling good-tempered, can speak to a patient who is recovering from an operation. So it will be that those who have newly passed over and are recuperating from the strain of passing over, just as a mother and baby recuperate from birth strains, so while this recuperation process is taking place, relatives can telephone a reception area and find out how the patient is doing. Naturally, when the patient is quite recovered and has gone to yet other dimensions, he or she will be too busy to be bothered by the petty little affairs of this earth. This earth is just a speck of dust existing for the twinkle of an eye in what is the real time. For those who are interested, I have actually seen such a telephone and actually seen it in use. It's a pity that the idiot press is not subject to censor it, because they should not be permitted to take foolish actions just for the sake of sensation, and so inhibit what are real developments. So Flo, let us consider this as a start, and the ending of the first chapter. We will go on together and see what we can do to answer some questions in the second. Pets on the Astral Plane. So extract from answering questions on page 34. Oh yes, among our questions, here is a question from a lady who asks about animals. Where is it now? Ah, here. Can you tell us what happens to our pets when they leave this earth? Are they utterly destroyed, or do they eventually reincarnate as humans? The Bible tells us that only humans go to heaven. What have you to say about it? Madame, I have a lot to say about it. The Bible was written a long time after the events related happened. The Bible is not the original writings either. It is a translation of a translation of a translation of another translation, which had been retranslated to suit some king or some political power, or something else. Think of the King James edition, or this edition or that edition. A lot of things written in the Bible are bunk. No doubt there was a lot of truth in the original scriptures, but a lot of things in the Bible now are no more truth than the truth of the press, and anyone knows what a lot of bilge that is. The Bible seems to teach humans that they are the lords of creation, that the whole world was made for man. Well, man has made an awful mess of the world, hasn't he? Where are there not wars, or rumors of wars? Where is there no sadism, no terror, no persecution? You will have to move off this earth if you want an answer to that. But we are dealing with animals and what happens to them. In the first case, there are many different species of creatures. Humans are animals, whether you like it or not. Humans are animals, horrid, uncouth, unfriendly animals, more savage than any of the nature type animals. Because humans have a thumb and fingers, they have been able to develop along certain lines because they can use their hands to fabricate things, and that animals cannot do. Man lives in a very material world and only believes that which he can grasp between his fingers and his thumb. Animals, not having thumbs and not being able to grasp a thing in two hands, have had to evolve spiritually, and most animals are spiritual. They do not kill unless for the absolute necessity of eating, and if a cat terrorizes and tortures a mouse, well, that is an illusion of the humors. The mouse is quite oblivious of it because it is hypnotized and feels no pain. Do you like that? Under stress, a person's sensations are anesthetized, so in times of war, for example, a man can have an arm shot off and apart from a very dim numbness, he will not feel it until loss of blood makes him weak. Or a person piloting a plane, for instance, can be shot through the shoulder, but he will go on piloting his plane and bring it down safely, and only when the excitement has ended will he feel pain. In the case of our mouse, by that time the mouse doesn't feel anything anymore. Horses do not reincarnate as daffodils. Marmosets do not reincarnate as maggots, or vice versa. There are different groups of nature people, each one in a separate isolated shell, which does not impinge upon the spiritual or astral existence of others. What that really means is that a monkey never reincarnates as a man never reincarnates as a mouse, although, admittedly, many men are mouse-like in their lack of intestinal fortitude, which is a very polite way of explaining, well, you know what? It is a definite statement of fact that no animal reincarnates as a human. I know humans are animals as well, but I am using the accepted, the commonly accepted term. One refers to humans and one refers to animals because humans like to be buttered up a bit, and so one pretends that they are not animals but a special form of creature, one of God's chosen, humans. So, the human animal never reincarnates as a canine animal or feline animal, or equine animal, and, again, our old friend vice versa. The human animal has one type of evolution which he must follow, the dash which, shall we say, has a different, and not necessarily parallel, form of evolution to follow. So they are not interchangeable entities. Many Buddhist scriptures refer to humans coming back as spiders or tigers or something else. But of course that is not believed by the educated Buddhist, that started as a misunderstanding many centuries ago in much the same way as there is a misunderstanding about Father Christmas, or about little girls being made of sugar and spice and all things nice. You and I know that all little girls are not nice, some of them are very nice, some of them are proper stinkers, but, of course, you and I, we only know the nice ones, don't we? When a human dies, the human goes to the astral plane, about which we shall say more later, and when an animal dies, it, too, goes to an astral plane where it is met by its own kind, where there is perfect understanding, where there is perfect rapport between them. As in the case of humans, animals cannot be bothered by those with whom they are incompatible, and now study this carefully: when a person who loves an animal dies and goes to the astral world, that person can be in contact with the loved animal, they can be together if there is absolute love between them. Further, if humans were more telepathic, if they were more believing, if they would open their minds and receive, then loved animals who had passed over could keep in touch with the humans even before the humans passed over. Let me tell you something, I have a number of little people who have passed over, and I am still very definitely, very much in contact with them. There is one little Siamese cat, Cindy, with Tom I am in daily contact, and Cindy has helped me enormously. On Earth she had a very bad time indeed. Now she is helping, helping, always helping. She is doing absolutely as much as anyone on the other side can do for anyone on this side. Those who truly love their so-called pets can be sure that when this life has ended for both, then they can come together again, but it's not the same. When humans are on the Earth they are a disbelieving crew, cynical, hard, blasé and all the rest. When they get to the other side they get a shake or two which enables them to realize that they are not the lords of creation they thought they were, but just part of a divine plan. On the other side they realize that others have rights as well. When they get to the other side they find that they can talk with utmost clarity to animals who are also on the other side, and animals will answer them in any language they care to use. It is a limitation on humans that most of them while on Earth are not telepathic, most of them, while on Earth, are not aware of the character and ability and powers of so-called animals. But when they pass over, it all comes clear to them, and humans then are like a person born blind who suddenly can see. Yes, animals go to heaven, not the Christian heaven, of course, but that is no loss. Animals have a real heaven. No angels with goose feathers for wings, it's a real heaven, and they have a Manu, or God, who looks after them. Whatever man can obtain or attain on the other side, so can an animal, peace, learning, advancement, anything and everything. Upon the earth man is in the position of being the dominant species, dominant because of the fearful weapons he has. Unarmed a man would be no match for a determined dog. Armed with some artificial method such as a gun, a man can dominate a whole pack of dogs, and it is only through man's viciousness that the telepathic power of communication with animals has been lost. That is the real story of the Tower of Babel, you know. Mankind was telepathic for general use, and mankind used speech only in local dialects for communicating with members of the family when they did not want the community as a whole to know what was being said. But then man lured animals into traps by false telepathy, by false promises. As a result mankind lost the telepathic power as a punishment, and now only a few people on this earth are telepathic, and for those of us who are, underscore it is like being a sighted person in the country of the blind. Underscore. Well, madame, to answer the question in your letter briefly. No. Humans do not reincarnate as animals, animals do not reincarnate as humans. Yes, animals go to heaven, and if you truly love your pet, then you can be together after you pass over if your love is truly love and not just selfish, senseless desire to dominate or possess. And, finally on this subject, animals are not an inferior species. Humans can do a vast number of things that animals cannot. Animals can do a vast number of things that humans cannot. They are different, and that's all there is to it. They are different, but not inferior. Now, Miss Cleo, resting so comfortably, looked up with those limpid blue eyes and sent a telepathic message: to work, we have to work or we do not eat. So saying, she rose gracefully and most delicately walked off. The old man, with a sigh, turned to another letter and another question. Are there mantras for sending dying animals to higher realms, and, if so, what are such mantras? One doesn't need mantras from humans to animals, just as humans have their own helpers waiting on the other side of life to help the dying human to be reborn back into the astral, so animals have their own helpers. And so there are no mantras necessary to help dying animals enter the astral world. Anyhow, animals know by instinct, or by pre-knowledge, far more about such things than do humans. One should not wait until an animal is dying before one is ready to help. The best way to help an animal is while it is alive and well on this earth, because animals are beautiful creatures, and there are no bad or vicious animals unless they have been made bad and vicious by the ill treatment, conscious or otherwise, of humans. I have known many cats, and I have never known a cat who was naturally vicious or bad-tempered. If a cat has been tormented by humans, or by human children most likely, then of course it does adopt a protective fierceness, but soon with a little kindness all that goes, and one has a gentle, devoted animal again. You know, a lot of people are scared stiff about Siamese cats, saying how fierce they are, how destructive, how everything bad. It isn't true, there isn't a word of truth in it, not a word. Miss Cleopatra and Miss Tadlinka never, never do anything to annoy us. If something irritates us, then we just say, "Oh, don't do that, Clee." And she doesn't do it again. Our cats do not tear up furniture or draperies because, we have a pact with them, we provide a very easily made scratching post, actually we have two. They are sturdy posts, strongly mounted on a square base, both are covered with heavy carpet, not old scruffy carpet on which one has upset the garbage pail, but new carpet, actually off cuts. Well, this carpeting has been securely fixed to the posts, and on top of the posts there is room for a cat to sit. Several times a day Cleopatra and Tadlinka go to their scratch posts, and they have such a long beautiful stretch that it makes one feel better just to watch. Sometimes they will walk up the post instead of jumping to the top, and that is very good for their muscles and very good for their claws. So, we provide the scratch posts and they provide the tranquility because we do not have to fear for any furniture or any draperies. Cats. Once I thought of writing a book about cat legends and the real story of cats. I'd love to, but increasing decrepitude makes it improbable that I ever shall. I would like to tell, for instance, how, on another world, in another system, far removed from the solar system, there was a high civilization of cats. In those days they could use their thumbs as humans could. But, just as humans are doing now, they fell from grace and they had a choice of starting around all over again or going to another system to help a race not yet born. Cats are kind creatures and understanding creatures, and so the whole race of cats and the Manu of cats decided to come to the planet we call Earth. They came to watch humans and report to other spheres on the behavior of humans, something like having a television camera watching all the time, but they watch and report not to harm humans, but to help them. In the better regions people do not report things to cause harm but only so that defects may be overcome. Cats came to be naturally independent so they would not be swayed by affection. They came as small creatures so that humans could treat them kindly or treat them harshly, according to the nature of the humans. Cats are benign, a good influence on Earth. Cats are a direct extension of a great overself of this world, a source of information where much information is distorted by world conditions. Be friendly with cats, treat them kindly, have faith in them, knowing that no cat has ever willingly harmed a human. But very, very many cats have died to help humans. Well, Miss Tadlinka has just rushed in with a telepathic message. Hey, Gov, guess what? There's 78 letters for you today. 78 letters. It's about time I got down to answering some which are waiting. Chapter 3. The right path is close at hand. Yet mankind searches for it afar. Lhasa today. A letter says, "What is life like in Lhasa today? Are novices having their third eye opened? What has happened to all the people you describe in the first book?" The Lhasa of 1970 under the terrorist rule of the Red Chinese is very, very different from the Lhasa of the era before the Chinese invasion. People are furtive, people look over their shoulders before venturing to speak to even the closest acquaintance. There are no beggars in the streets now, they have either been nailed up by their ears and are long since dead, or they have been sent to forced labor. Women are not the happy, carefree people they used to be. Now in Chinese-dominated Tibet, women are forcibly mated with Chinese men who have been deported from China and sent to Tibet to be the first colonists. The Chinese are guilty of genocide. They are trying to kill the Tibetan nation. Chinese men were torn from their families in China and sent to Tibet to till the hard soil and to scrape a living somehow, sent to Tibet to mate with unwilling women and to be the fathers of a race of half-breeds, half Chinese and half Tibetan. As soon as a child is born, it is taken away from the parents and placed in a communal home where it is taught as it grows up to hate all things Tibetan and to worship all things Chinese. Tibetan men are being dealt with so that they are men no longer, so that they can no longer be fathers. Many men, and many women too, have escaped perhaps to India or perhaps to the higher mountain recesses where the Chinese troops cannot climb. The Tibetan race will not die out. The Tibetan race will continue. It is a tragedy that the higher-ranking Tibetans now in India do not stir up interest in saving Tibet. At one time I had the fond hope some of these higher-ups would put aside their petty jealousies and petty hatreds and they would have cooperated with me. I have long had the great desire to speak as a representative of Tibet before the United Nations. I am not dumb, I am not illiterate, I know the side of the East and I know the side of the West. And it has long been my most fervent desire to serve Tibet by appealing to the free peoples of the world on behalf of the people now enslaved, now facing determined attempts to extinguish the whole race. But unfortunately I have been called many things, and those higher ups, living in comfort in India, have not seen fit to do much about saving Tibet. However, that is another matter, and is one man's ambition, an ambition, though, which is entirely unselfish, for I sought nothing for myself. My books are true, every single one of them, they are absolutely true. But, unfortunately, the press saw fit to attack me. After all, it's so much easier and so much more sensational for the press to try to pull down a person and try to make a blood and thunder tale out of something which doesn't exist than to admit the truth. It seems to me, looking back through the years, that those high-ranking Tibetans in India, now living there in considerable comfort, are afraid to support me in the mistaken idea that if they did so, they would lose the support of the press. Who cares about the press, anyhow? I don't. People I have known in Tibet, the most highly placed of them have been killed, tortured to death. For example, Tibet's prime minister was dragged behind a speeding car through the streets of Lhasa. A rope was tied around one ankle, the other end of the rope was tied to the back of a car. The car was loaded with jeering Chinese, and off it started pulling an eminent man through the streets, turning and twisting on the rocky road, tearing off his nose, tearing off his ears, tearing off other things, until, raw red and soaking with blood, he was just tossed aside on a garbage heap for dogs to devour. Women whom I knew? Well, their daughters have been publicly raped in front of their families as well. Many eminent women have been forced into brothels for Chinese troops. The list could go on long about such happenings, but there is no point in it. Certain cowardly men of high estate capitulated to the Chinese demands and became lackeys of the Chinese, obeying their every whim, aping them, fawning upon them, and remaining in positions of trust until their masters tired of them and liquidated them. Yet others escaped into the mountains to continue the fight against the Chinese. Many, of course, went to India. Well, that's their choice, but again the thought comes, why would not the great ones, safely in India, do something to help those who were not safe? In the great temples and at the Potala itself, all the gold sheets forming the roof have been torn off and carried away to China, where, presumably, the gold has been melted down and made into money or something. Sacred figures have been melted down for their gold and silver content, precious jewels have been removed and taken to China, and other things, books, manuscripts, paintings and carvings, have been tossed upon a great bonfire and the whole lot burnt up. And with it the history of a harmless, innocent country, devoted only to the good of mankind. Lamaseries are now brothels or barracks. Nunneries, well, the Chinese regard them as ready-made brothels. Ancient monuments have been torn down to afford easier passage for armored columns. Lhasa now is the capital city of terror, where people are tortured and killed without knowing the reason why. All that was beautiful has been destroyed. End of this extract. Drugs and the astral. A drug addict who dies and passes over to the astral world has a truly horrible time. He has to go to what is in effect an astral mental hospital, because his astral body is warped and distorted, and it may take a long, long time before the most skilled attention that he can receive can restore that astral body to anything like a workable condition. People rave about this entirely evil drug LSD. Think of the number of suicides there have been, the ones that are reported, and think of the ones that have not been reported. Think of the harm that has been caused in terms of insanity and violence. LSD, marijuana, heroin, all those things, they are all devilishly evil. Unfortunately, young people do not seem able to accept the advice of older people, people who have the experience. It is true that, for example, LSD will get the astral body separated from the physical body, but all too often, unfortunately, the astral body goes down to one of the lower hells, one of the weirdy astral planes, and when it comes back the subconscious itself is seared with the horrors it has undergone. Again, remember that this was written in 1970. Years before people like Stanislav Grof and similar wrote books about out-of-the-body experiences in connection with the use of LSD, and in the recent years there has appeared research material that confirms what Rampa wrote, but 20 years earlier. Conscious. So, young people who should be reading this, stay away from drugs. Never mind if you do think drug X or drug Y is harmless. If they are taken without medical supervision, you might have some idiosyncrasy which will make you particularly susceptible to those drugs, and very quickly you will be hooked beyond hope of recovery. Remember, all these drugs are harmful, and although by some remote chance it might now show on your physical for the time being, yet it will show very definitely upon your astral and on your aura. By the way, if people do take drugs and they damage their astral bodies, then they come under the same category as do suicides, and if a person commits suicide then he or she has to come back to this earth to finish his or her sentence, which is one way of looking at it, or to complete his or her lessons, which is another way of looking at it. Whichever way you look at it, there are no dropouts from the heavenly fields, no dropouts from this earth either. If you gum up the works this time and do not learn the things which you came here to learn, then you come back and back and back again until you do learn your lessons. So this drug business is a very serious thing indeed, and no action taken by the government can be in any way too severe to deal with the drug problem. The best way to deal with it is for each and every one of us to decide that we will not take drugs. In that way we shall not be spiritual suicides, and we shall not have to come back to this earth into steadily worsening conditions. Suicides. In the last paragraph one referred to spiritual suicides, repeating the remarks in others of my books about suicides. I receive an amazing number of letters from people who tell me that they are going to commit suicide. Perhaps they have been crossed in love, perhaps they weren't crossed in love and lived to regret it. But whatever it is, I have been appalled at the number of people who write to me saying they are going to commit suicide. Let me state once again, as I have stated constantly, suicide is never, never justified. If one commits suicide, one just gets slapped back to this earth to enter class once again. So, do not think that you can escape your responsibilities by cutting your throat or slashing your wrists, or anything like that. You can't. Some years ago a boy who was somewhat unstable apparently committed suicide and left a note to say he was going to come back in a few years' time. Well, unfortunately, a copy of one of my books, You, Forever, was found near him, and the press really had a Roman holiday. They went delirious with joy, they raked up everything they could think of, and then they called in other people to see if they could think of anything else. And, you know, the most amazing thing of all is that it was reported in the press that I encouraged suicide. Actually, I have never encouraged suicide. I often think I would like to murder press people, but that fate would be far too good for them. Let them go on making their mistakes and let them pay for it after. I personally believe that the majority of press people are subhuman. I personally believe that the press is the most evil force on this earth today because the press distorts things and tries to whip up excitement or frenzy, tries to drive people to war. If government leaders could sit down together and discuss matters without the press blaring out a collection of lies and ruining friendly relations, then we should have more peace. Yes, emphatically, based on my own experiences, I am firmly of the belief that the press is the most evil force on this world today. I mention all this because even the press reported that the boy thought he would come back and start again. Well, that was right. The boy would have to come back again. But let me again repeat, I never, never encourage suicide. As I have stated unchangingly for the whole of my life, suicide is never justified, and while some Buddhists apparently do it in the belief that it is going to help the Buddhist cause or the cause of peace, I still maintain that suicide is never justified. So my strong recommendation is do not even contemplate suicide, it doesn't help. You will have to come back under worse conditions. And if you stick it out here nearly always it's not so bad as one fears. The worst things of all never happen, you know, we only think they might. Now here is a question which came only yesterday. A lady asks, the cloud which stays over a body for 3 days, is it the soul or the astral body? Doesn't the soul leave soon for the other side? Well, yes. Of course. The soul leaves the body with the cutting of the silver cord just the same as a child is entirely detached from its mother's body as the umbilical cord is detached. Until that umbilical cord is severed, then the child is in coexistence with its mother. In the same way, until the silver cord is disconnected, the astral body is coexistent with the physical body. The cloud which hangs over a dead body for 3 days or so is just the accrued energy dissipating. Look at it in another way. Suppose you have a cup of tea, the tea is poured out and before you can drink it you are called away. The tea stays hot, but becomes cooler, and cooler, and cooler, so, in the same way, until the body has lost all the energy built up during the lifetime, a cloud hovers over the body, gradually dispersing over 3 days. Another illustration, suppose you have a coin in your hot little hand and you suddenly put down the coin, the energy imparted in the form of heat from your hot little hand doesn't suddenly disperse, it takes a certain amount of time for the heat put in the coin by your hand to go, and for the coin to return to the ordinary temperature surrounding it. In the same way, an astral body can be quite detached from the physical body, but by the principle of magnetic attraction it can still sense the charge around the physical body, and so until all that charge has gone, it is said that the physical body and the astral body are connected. Proof. A lady, I am sure she is a lady because she writes in such an elegant manner, takes me to task somewhat, why do you occultists always say this is so, and that is so? But offer no proof. People must have proof. Why do you not give proof? Why should we believe anything? God has never said a word to me, and the astronauts have not seen any sign of heaven in space. Proof. That's one of the biggest things, but tell me this, if one is a sighted person in the country of the blind, how does one give proof that there is sight? Moreover, how do you give proof when so many people will not believe a thing when it's stuck slap in front of their nose? There have been many very eminent scientists, quite a number of famous names have been interested in proof, in science cooperating with the occult world. For example, Sir Oliver Lodge, a most spiritual man, addressed a very important association in 1913 in England. Sir Oliver said, "Either we are immortal beings or we are not. We may not know our destiny, but we must have a destiny of some sort. Science may not be able to reveal human destiny, but it certainly should not obscure JT." He went on to say that in his opinion the present-day methods of science would not work in securing proof. He said also that it was his belief that if reputable scientists were allowed to work free without all the scoffers and doubters, Then they could reduce occult occurrences to physical laws, and that is obviously very much so. People who demand proof in the terms of bricks standing upon bricks. They want proof while all the time they are trying to prevent that proof. People who go into occult studies just trying to get a material proof are like people who go into a dark room and turn on the lights to see if there is any image on the yet undeveloped film. Their actions definitely inhibit any manifestation of proof. In the occult world, we are dealing with intangible matters, we are dealing with matters of an extremely high vibration, and the way people go along nowadays is something like using a pneumatic road drill to excavate in order that fillings may be put in one's teeth. Before proof can be given in a materialistic sense, scientists have to be trained in what can be and what cannot be. It's useless for them to charge like a bull at a gate. They are not breaking bricks, they are trying to find out something which is as basic as humanity itself. If people will be honest with themselves, if they will stay away from the television screens and the cinemas and all that stuff, and if they will meditate properly, then they will have an inner awareness of what such a thing is. They will become aware of their own spiritual natures, always assuming that their spiritual nature is not so debased as to preclude any other manifestation. For years, in addition to wanting to photograph the aura which I see around every person, I have wanted to develop, as I have already stated, a telephone which would enable the ordinary people, non-clairvoyant, non-clairaudient people to telephone the other side. Think what fun it would be looking up a heavenly telephone directory and having to ask for information, did he go up or down? I suppose the nether regions would have an exchange called brimstone, or something similar. Anyway, in years to come when scientists are less materialistic, then it will be that there will be such a telephone. Actually there has been, but that is another story. Perhaps I should head the next bit's top press news because there has been a telephone call from John Henderson, some 3,000 miles away. He has now had some proof of people on the other side of this life. A message came to him and he had the sensation that he was having his head kicked, which is what I once told him I would like to do to him. But anyway, he just phoned to say that at last he has got the message. That message was directed from the other side and not at all impelled by me. Someday perhaps John Henderson may write a book, he should, and if he tells about this occurrence many people will probably say, well, I never. I wouldn't like such things to happen to me. Astral Travel and Dreams. Page 73. It is impossible to confuse astral travel with dreams or nightmares because in dreams there is nearly always some inconsistency. Come improbability, therein always some element which is at variance with what you know to be fact. The colors may be wrong, or you may, for example, see a person with the head of a tiger. It can be determined, with a little practice, that which is a dream and that which is astral travel. Memories of dreams and memories of astral travel follow the same path into one's awareness when one is awake. When the psyche comes back and the body awakens, it may say, oh, I had a terrible dream last night. Or if the person has training and knows how to astral travel consciously, then he comes back with a complete knowledge of all he has done. The body is still rested, the toxins are still dispersed, but the psyche has retained the information of what happened in the astral world. Some school children have a holiday and they are so excited at coming back to school that everything that happened during the holiday completely disappears from their brains or from their memories, and in just the same way people coming back from astral travel may forget completely all that happened in the excitement of starting another day. It cannot be too often repeated that if one wants to remember astral travel, then one just simply must say to oneself 3 times before going to sleep, I will sleep soundly and restfully, and in the morning I will be aware of all that I have done in the astral. Repeat that 3 times before going to sleep, and if you really think what you are saying, and if you really mean what you are saying, then you will remember when you awaken. There is nothing magical about it, it's just getting through to a rather stupid subconscious and saying, in effect, hey bud, you've got to keep alert tonight. No playing about and gumming up the works with my memories, you keep out of the way, ready for a fresh load of memories when I return. Of course, the person who is trained in astral travel can astral travel when he is fully awake. It is quite usual for the trained person to sit down in a chair, clasp his hands and put his feet close together and then just close his eyes. He can then will himself to leave the body and go anywhere and stay fully conscious during the whole period of astral travel, so that when the astral body rejoins the physical body, there is brought back a completely retained memory of all that happened. That takes practice, of course, and a bit of self-discipline. It is not difficult to train oneself to remember all that happened when the body is asleep. You just have to tell your subconscious to shut up, exactly as you tell an unruly schoolboy to shut up. The first telling is more or less a waste of time. At the second telling, the subconscious jumps to awareness, and with the third telling, it is hoped that the command sinks in and the subconscious will obey. But if you do this for a few nights, you will find that the subconscious does obey. Notebook and pencil by the bedside. Many people like to keep a notebook and pencil by the bedside so that immediately upon awakening in the morning, the knowledge of what happened in the night can be written down. Otherwise, with the press and turmoil of modern living, there is a great tendency to forget what happened. A poor fellow will awaken, for example, and think he is going to be late for work, and then next he will wonder if his wife is in a good temper and will get his breakfast, or if he will have to go without. So with things like that on his mind, he is not much in a mood to remember what happened in the night. So make a definite practice, keep a notebook and pencil by your bedside, and the very first thing you do when you awaken, write down immediately everything you remember of the night. With practice you will find it's easy, and with a bit more practice you won't need your notebook and your pencil. You will carry out your days on earth with much more contentment, knowing that this is just a hard school and nothing more, knowing that at the end of the school term you will be able to return home. Sleep learning. Of late there seems to have been a rash of advertisements from all sorts of firms who purport to teach one sleep learning. They want to sell one expensive gizmos and even more expensive taped courses, complete with time switch, headphones, under the pillow speaker, and what have you. Now it is quite impossible for anyone to learn anything worthwhile while asleep. To start with, the driver of the body is away, and all that is left is a sort of crummy caretaker called subconscious, and very extensive researches in the leading countries of the world have proved beyond doubt that sleep learning is not possible. It doesn't work. If you stay awake, that is, if you are slow in going to sleep, then you may pick up a few snatches of conversation from the tapes. But there is no easy way of learning. You can't press a button and say, "Hey presto," to a machine, because that will not make you a genius overnight. Instead, it will interrupt your sleep rhythm and make you a bad-tempered, unmentionable you-know-what. Suppose you leave your car in the garage while you go in your house to have your buttered beans on toast, or whatever it is that you have before going to bed. Well, you would be quite a bit of an optimist in thinking your car was going to learn through tapes while you were away from it. The car manufacturers admittedly make several lurid and impossible claims for their mechanized tin boxes. "No, I do not have a car," but even the most optimistic of car advertisers would balk at saying their cars would learn during the owner's sleep. Your body is just a vehicle. A vehicle whereby your over-self can gain some experience on Earth and on a few other assorted planets, so don't give yourself a lot of airs about how clever you are, how important you are, and all that, because when it comes down to brass tacks or whatever standard of value you want to use, you are just a lump of protoplasm which is driven around by day, by an owner who happens to be your over-self. You can liken it to the Irishman and his donkey. The donkey stays in the stable by night, but no amount of tapes will enable the donkey to speak English or even American, yet during the day the owner can be taught to learn, even American. It might be worth trying to teach an Irishman Welsh one day to see if that can be done. I think actually I deserve a medal for pointing out to you some of these things which are designed to take your hard-earned money from you. Always think, what's behind the advertisement? Well, obviously, the advertiser wants to get your money. It reminds me of the people who advertise how to take a million in, say, 3 easy lessons, or how to forecast the Irish sweepstake and win the first prize. If these people who could do such things did them, then they wouldn't bother to advertise, would they? And if they can't do it, well, they have to make money in some other way, by pretending that they can make millions in a month. They can if enough people reply to their advertisements, but don't you be one of them. Button up your pocket, keep your handbag shut, keep your mouth shut too, and your ears wide open. The subconscious. A repository of knowledge. Oh glory be, and all the rest of it. Now here's a question you'd better get ready to read this carefully. You say the subconscious is stupid, yet in chapters of life it is said to be very, very intelligent. It seems to be more intelligent than the part of us you say is 1/10 conscious. Now, tell us straight out, is it stupid or is it super intelligent? If we are going down into basics again, like this, then we have to say that the subconscious is neither intelligent nor unintelligent because it doesn't have intelligence. It's a different sort of thing altogether. The subconscious is just a repository of knowledge, good knowledge, bad knowledge. It's just a filing system. It contains all you have ever heard, all you have ever seen, all you have ever experienced. It reminds your automatic responses when to breathe in and when to breathe out. It reminds part of you to wriggle and screech if you are tickled, etc. It's just an automatic reminder. Would you say that a librarian is intelligent? Well, that's a matter of opinion, of course. I know I tried to deal with those silly librarians at a famous library in London, the ones who put down details, and I tried to tell these people that the details they were putting down about me were utterly and incontrovertibly incorrect, but it's such a job convincing some of them, and I am left with the indelible opinion that the record library librarians at that famous library are not intelligent. Anyway, that's a matter of opinion. But let us make that query again just for the sake of answering this question. Would you consider that a librarian was a genius? Would you consider that a librarian could answer any question about anything and say what any person has said before? Well, of course you couldn't. Not even if you were a librarian yourself could you make such claims. Instead you would say, quite correctly, that, no, there is no such knowledge in a conscious human. But a librarian knows where to find certain information. The best librarians are those who can find the information fastest. You and I could go to a library and fumble our way through certain filing cabinets in search of a book title containing matter on the subject of interest. Then we would find we had to refer to something else. Then we would find that the book was out of print or out of circulation or out of the library. We would waste half a day or more. Yet by asking a librarian there is a second during which he has an absolutely blank expression, and then the penny seems to drop with a clank, and he or she gets into motion and produces the book with the desired information. If he or she is good at the work, they recommend many more books. The subconscious is like that. As soon as the thinking we desires to know something, then the subconscious tries to come up with the answer. That is not intelligence. That is entirely automatic, and as it's automatic it can be trained. Trained for what? Well, the answer is simple. Your subconscious is your memory. If you have a poor memory it means that your conscious 1/10 is not getting through to your subconscious 9/10. If you have a poor memory it means that the subconscious is falling down on the job of providing you the information which you demand. Supposing you want to know what Gladstone really said back in the year 18 something or other. Well, you've probably heard it, you've probably read of it, so it's in your memory and if your subconscious cannot bring it out, it means that there is a fault in a relay somewhere. Some people can reel off a terrible lot of stuff about football or baseball teams, and give all the winners or whatever they are called for years back, but that is because they are interested in the subject. And people cannot remember things in which they are not interested. Never having seen a football match or a baseball match, and not wanting to, I haven't the vaguest idea about it. I thought that a baseball diamond, for instance, was a thing given to prize winners, No doubt somebody will write in to tell me differently. If you want to cultivate a good memory, then you have to cultivate your subconscious. You have to be interested in a subject, until you are interested the subconscious cannot tag on. Many of our lady readers will know all about the male film star, how many times he has been married, how many times he has been divorced, and how many times he has chased his beloved for the moment around the world. That's easy, they can do that. But just ask them to go and get a standard fine thread from a local shop, perhaps a 3/16 standard fine thread, and they'll come back looking blanker than usual. To train your memory, that is, to train your subconscious, you should think clearly about things and assume an interest in those things. If men are sent shopping for women's things, well, they come back without a single thought in their heads. But if they took an interest in things, then their memory would improve. One can take an interest by asking oneself why a woman wants this, or that, or something else, and the woman can ask herself why a man should want, for instance, a 3/16 bolt of fine thread. If she can get a definite interest, then he or she can remember. Influencing others positively under sleep. Another thing which can be done during the period of sleep is to approach another person whom one desire to influence. Now, sleep learning is useless, that is absolutely a waste of time because you are trying to teach the body something when the entity that controls the body is out of the body. But let us deal with something else - influencing others. Supposing that Mr. John Brown very much desires to get an appointment with the firm of Versailles Manufacturing Company. Mr. Brown has heard that this company is an extremely good company and that it is definitely desirable to be employed by such a firm. Mr. Brown has had some good fortune in getting an appointment with the personnel manager or someone else in authority for, say, the following day. Now, if Mr. Brown really wants to sell himself, this is what he will do. He will get hold of any information he can about the firm and especially about the person with whom he has the interview. That means that Mr. Brown must make a definite inquiry as to who will do the interviewing. Then if it is at all possible, he will get a photograph of the interviewer, and before going to bed that night Mr. Brown will sit quite alone and he will visualize himself talking to the interviewer on the morrow. Mr. Brown will convincingly state, in the privacy of his bedroom, the reasons why he would be a desirable employee, the reasons why he needs that particular appointment, the reasons why he considers he is worth more than the firm normally pays. He says all this to the photograph, then he lifts up his feet and tucks them in bed, and he puts the photograph so that it is facing him as he lies on his accustomed side. Mr. Brown goes to sleep with the firm, very definite, very emphatic intention of getting out of his body and journeying to Mr. Interviewer's house. There he will meet Mr. Interviewer out of his body, and Mr. Brown's astral will tell Mr. Interviewer's astral all that Mr. Brown has just said in the privacy of his bedroom. Fantastic? Daft? Don't you believe it? This really works. If the interviewer plays his cards properly, then the interviewer will give him the job. That is sure. That is definite, it really works. Now, you who want a better job or more money, go through those words again and put them into practice. You can influence people in this way, but not necessarily for bad. You cannot influence a person to do that which he or she would not normally do, that is, you cannot influence a person to do an evil or wrong act. Which means that some of you fellows who write into me asking how to get power over girls, well, you can't, friend, you can't, and don't try. Yes, innocent readers, ladies of high degree and of the utmost purity, I sometimes get letters from gentlemen who ask me to teach them to hypnotize girls or to put spells on girls or to produce the formula of something which will render girls helpless so that the gentleman - well, what would he do under such circumstances? Anyway, I tell them the truth, which is that unless they go in for poisoning, they cannot influence another person to do that which the other person's conscience would not normally permit. So there you are. If your desires are pure or clean, then you can influence others, you can influence others to do good, but not to do bad. Most people don't need influencing to do bad anyhow, it seems to come natural. Coming to Earth for a special task, parallels between the life and death of President Lincoln and Kennedy. It might be as well here to introduce a question having bearing on some of the remarks made in previous chapters. The question is, you say that people come to this earth time after time until the person concerned does his specific task. You also say that at times groups of people come for the same purpose. Can you give any definite illustration on that point? As a matter of fact, yes, quite definitely, yes. Now, I had a cutting some time ago in the Spanish language, and this Spanish language thing gave a lot of details about a magazine called Excalibur which had been published some years ago, apparently, in Durban, South Africa. I have only a very, very brief comment on the whole matter, but it seems the magazine published some remarkable proven parallels between the life and death of President Lincoln of the USA and President Kennedy of the USA. This will so adequately reply to many querents that I will give all the details here. Let us do them numerically, as then it will be so much easier if you want to refer to them or discuss them with your friends. So here the first one is. 1. President Lincoln was elected to that office in the year 1860. That, of course, can be ascertained from history books. So, Lincoln became president in 1860, and here is the first coincidence: Kennedy became president in 1960, 100 years later. 2. It might shake you to know that President Lincoln was assassinated on a Friday. President Kennedy was assassinated on a Friday. 3. You may have read that President Lincoln was at a theater enjoying a stage show in the presence of his wife, and he was then assassinated in the presence of his wife. President Kennedy was visiting Dallas, Texas, and he was riding in a car with his wife. He also was enjoying the show, that is, the show of public acclaim, etc. 4. President Lincoln was shot in the back while sitting in a box at the theater. President Kennedy was shot in the back while sitting in a car. 5. President Lincoln was succeeded by a man called Johnson. Johnson became president after President Lincoln, but in Texas President Kennedy was killed and Vice President Johnson was sworn in as President of the USA on board an aircraft bringing the body of the late president and the living new president back to the Capitol. 6. But we have not finished with our list of coincidences, yet, not by a long way. The Johnson who succeeded President Lincoln was a Democrat from South USA, and Lyndon Johnson who succeeded President Kennedy also is a Democrat from the South, from Texas. So that is quite a good list of coincidences, isn't it? Though to show that there is more than chance taking a part in things. Enough to show that there must be some divine plan making the entity who was President Lincoln perhaps come back as Kennedy, so that a task could be accomplished. All right, let's get back with. 7. Both the Johnsons had been members of the Senate before becoming president. 8. Lincoln's successor was Andrew Johnson. Now really read this. Andrew Johnson was born in 1808. But the Johnson who succeeded President Kennedy was born in 1908. 9. Lincoln was assassinated by a rather strange sort of a person, a thoroughly dissatisfied sort of person if we are to believe the report, which is now history, and that assassin of Lincoln was John Wilkes Booth and he was born in 1839. Lee Harvey Oswald who, it was stated, murdered President Kennedy appears also to have been a very dissatisfied sort of person, one who had been in trouble all too frequently. He was born in 1939. 10. To continue with our list of coincidences, Booth was assassinated before he could be brought to trial, but so was Oswald. Oswald was shot while being moved by the police, and before he could be brought to trial. These coincidences, as you have seen, extend not only to the presidents and the assassins, but also to the wives of the presidents because Mrs. Lincoln, the wife of President Lincoln, lost a child while in the White House, and Mrs. Kennedy, the wife of President Kennedy, lost a child while in the White House. 12. Lincoln had a secretary, and that secretary was called Kennedy. Secretary Kennedy advised President Lincoln most strongly not to go to the theater where he was assassinated. President Kennedy had a secretary also, and he was called Lincoln, and Secretary Lincoln strongly advised President Kennedy not to go to Dallas. 13. John Wilkes Booth shot President Lincoln in the back while the president was watching a show, and then the assassin, Booth, ran to hide in a store. But Lee Harvey Oswald shot at Kennedy from a store and ran to hide in a theater. You just read that carefully again and see how very strange it is. One assassin shot in a theater and hid in a store, the other one shot from a store and hid in a theater. 14. Lincoln is 7 letters, and if you count up Kennedy, you will find that it also has 7 letters. 15. If you count John Wilkes Booth, you will find that there are 15 letters, and if you count Lee Harvey Oswald, you will find that that has 15 letters. 16. It is believed that Oswald killed Kennedy and Oswald had accomplices. None of this has been actually, definitely, incontrovertibly proved. It is a matter of circumstantial evidence. No one can prove that Booth murdered Lincoln. In the same way Oswald, it was stated, had accomplices. But it has not been conclusively proved that Oswald did murder Kennedy, and it has not been proved that Oswald had accomplices. Let's face it quite bluntly, circumstantial evidence points clearly at Booth and at Oswald, but again, how much of what we could read was actual truth and how much was the press prejudging and pre-condemning a man? We do not know, and I point out this because it is another coincidence in the case of two men. 17. You will remember that the man called Ruby, who was a bit of a fanatic, killed Oswald. He shot Oswald in front of the television cameras. He just pushed his way past the police, pointed a gun and pulled a trigger. But Boston Corbett was also a bit of a fanatic. He too believed that he was doing right when he murdered John Wilkes Booth. In both cases these two men killed the man suspected and accused of the murder of a president. And in both cases it was stated that the second assassin, that is Corbett and Ruby, did so out of excessive loyalty for the president at the time. But in neither case is the actual motive established. In another book I wrote about the over-self-managing a group of puppets. Well, you think about that in the light of this information, where two presidents were elected 100 years apart. They were both assassinated on a Friday, and look through the list again and see all the different coincidences. Now, do you seriously believe that these could be just coincidences? It isn't really possible, you know. My own belief is that Lincoln did not do his job, and so he had to come back to substantially the same job to finish what he did not do before. The only way to come back was to come back as one who would be president of the USA, which is what he did. You can take it that sometimes an overself has dress rehearsals with puppets, so in the case of Lincoln the stage was set, appropriately enough, at a theater, and a president was assassinated. Nothing was proved against the assumed murderer, and the assumed murderer was assassinated by another person. It was almost unsatisfactory, motives were unknown and nothing was ever proved against anyone. So perhaps the overself got a bit fed up with such a waste of time and effort, and another arrangement was made. For 100 years later, because in the astral world time is different from here, you know. The other side of death, the astral could have sat down and scratched his metaphorical head, so to speak, and wondered what to do next. Well, by the time he had fidgeted around and scratched a bit more, 100 years by Earth time would be slipping by. One also wonders what happens now. Was that overself satisfied with the second attempt, or will there be a third? Personally, I believe that we shall yet see a president of the USA who is actually put in seclusion for being insane. Now I know all the old jokes about presidents of the USA being mad in any case, and far be it from me to discourage them. But this time it is a serious matter. And I believe that before too long we shall see a president of the USA who has to be relieved of his duties because he is too insane to continue.